The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Live from Northern California, it's Lifeline with Craig Roberts. He's the host of Northern California's longest-running conservative talk show. He's a man with a message, a conservative with compassion. He's Lifeline's own Craig Roberts.
Well, I know what some of you are thinking. You're thinking, boy, is it that time again? And others are thinking, boy, is it that time again? Yes, indeed. Well, whatever the perspective might be, yes, indeed it is. 5 minutes after the hour, 5 o'clock, and of course, a Tuesday, and on your radio once again, Craig Roberts. Welcome. Good to have you with us, and trust you're having a good day so far. Good start to the week. Lots to talk about on today's program, so we're just going to dive right in. You might have heard they had an election in Russia. Not sure why. Boy, without regard to what some opinions may be in relationship to our own challenges here at home, probably nobody does fake elections the way the Russians and the North Koreans. And I always laugh because the campaigning, they're out on the speech, giving the, you know, out on the campaign trail, giving the speeches and whatnot. And you know that the gig is already up. I mean, it's in the bag. They're going to be the next candidate, no doubt about it. Take, for example, in Russia, the recent Russian campaign of Vladimir Putin to win his fifth running presidential election. Well, you know, it's kind of easy to prognosticate as to who the winner is going to be when there is little, if any, opposition. The only opposition that's running is the opposition that is allowed to run. The Kremlin very carefully choosing the opponents, knowing they don't pose any real threat, so that you can give the appearance of there being political freedom and free elections when, in fact, just the opposite is true. It's happened for, my goodness, decades now running in North Korea where, yeah, every 4 years they hold an election and, oh, what a surprise, somebody whose last name is Kim wins the election again. Well, when no one runs against you or when those that do, they know, don't dare vote for them. So they come in with a 99-point-something% victory, and they're off to continue to do what they really are, to be what they really are, a dictator. Let's talk about all this from the results, the surprise, shocking results out of Moscow, and so much more. Joining us is the publisher of Reimagine America, Joyce Cordy. As always, Joyce, what a delight to have you with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And I know it came as a great surprise when the Kremlin announced that, indeed, Mr. Putin will be remaining in his seat for another term. Shock, awe, surprise. Maybe for clarification for listeners, what is the motivation? Is this just simply to be able to have bragging rights that you have a quote-unquote election when in reality we know it's a sham election?
Not to give it a veneer of legitimacy in front of the world. As crazy as that sentence sounds, because, I mean, after all, Putin only got 88.7% of the vote this time, and they did have some protesters. Navalny's widow had organized this Sunday noontime voting rally in major cities in Moscow, and people showed up just as they showed up at Navalny's funeral, but he's still dead and couldn't run in this election, and people did throw paint and do other things. And on the other hand, in the Donbas of Ukraine, the occupied portion of Ukraine, well, the Russian soldiers went out and got all the Ukrainian people to come and express their support for Putin and his regime at the point of the gun. literally.
Yeah.
March people to the polls at the wrong end of a rifle. You know, that's what they call a free and fair election in Russia.
I recall, this is years back, the late William L. Schreier, who was a reporter for CBS News in Germany during World War II, wrote a famous book, The Rise and Fall of Nazi Germany, a huge seller after the war. And in one of the chapters, he interviews some people who were present in Austria when the Anschluss took place. And, of course, you know, here is Hitler as a German coming into an Austrian country, albeit his land of birth. And you see all the streets lined with people throwing flowers and roses, and they're all thrilled to suddenly be annexed by Germany. And so Schreier asked this Austrian who was present at all of this, why? What happened? I mean, were you that genuinely thrilled to essentially be gobbled up by Germany? And the answer came back, oh, heck no. But you don't have much of a choice when the German soldiers show up and say, hey, look, we're going to do a parade here in a little while, and Hitler's going to be coming through. We want you to scream and shout and lift your hand in salute and show how enthusiastic you are for Germany to now be in charge of Austria. Because if you don't, you're going to be dead. So it's easy to get a crowd, apparently, under those circumstances.
You get to go to a concentration camp if you don't show up. So, you know, what can I say? Except that Putin's little victory was somewhat the same as the Nazi annexation, the Anschluss of Austria, in the sense that the curtains came off. His Peter the Great imperial designs or ambitions, if you'd like to call them that, all of a sudden, the leaders of breakaway, in other words, invaded portions of both the country of Georgia and Moldova, neither of whom are NATO members, by the way. But their breakoff republic leaders rushed to Moscow on election victory day to kiss the hand. Okay? But that was not a universal reaction to Putin's speech, which was really Peter the Great imperial. The Poles, who are having their own economic issues, have decided that they must, and they are NATO members, they've got to begin a massive and immediate bomb shelter building program in Warsaw and other major metropolitan urban centers in Poland.
Now let's pause on that point, because that's
how scared they are that if Ukraine falls, they're next.
Well, let's pause on that point, Joyce, because I think it's such an important one. We know that recently both Sweden and Finland were entered into or permitted to be members of NATO. Poland is in a very difficult position in that the memories of the events of 1939 still undoubtedly smack, albeit perhaps the memory of such fading with the passing of each generation. But the reality is that allies on the continent, like France, like Britain, had promised to defend Poland were she to be attacked. Of course, they ended up doing absolutely nothing in September of 39 when Hitler marched in. And a lot of people are perhaps unaware of or blind to the fact that it wasn't just Germany that attacked Poland. In fact, there had been an agreement between Russia and Germany that allowed them to essentially share the spoils. And Hitler wanted to go in so far to get access to the oil fields, and essentially Stalin wanted the rest. And so there was an agreement inked in Berlin between Foreign Minister Molotov and Adolf Hitler, and they decided to divvy the country in half. And that certainly marked the beginning of World War II, but it should be noted that early on, none of the Allies did anything to lift a finger to protect or to respond to the attack on Poland. And in 30 days, Warsaw had fallen to German hands. I think it says a lot, Joyce, when Poland says we're going to start building bomb shelters. I mean, a lot of that sort of bomb shelter activity disappeared with the fall of the Iron Curtain. But when Warsaw thinks that it's so important that they begin building bomb shelters again, that really speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because they were mentioned specifically in Putin's little victory speech. When he gets through with the Ukraine, he's looking at Poland as being a natural portion of Russia.
Wow.
And so, and yet, Speaker of the House Johnson dithers over Ukraine funding from the United States.
Yes, a little disingenuous. I mean, given the ways in which we waste money in so many fashions, not to suggest that supporting a democracy would be a waste, but we've had a history post-World War II of stepping up to the plate and defending democracies, whether they're just fledgling and they need some help, or they are democracies that are facing extinction by an outside enemy, in this case, Russia attacking Ukraine. And the fact that here, for the first time, certainly in my memory, America, instead of saying, okay, let's go and help out, we're saying, nope, not interested, can't afford it anymore. I mean, I find it interesting that now at the 30-plus trillion mark, we've suddenly found our economic conscience, and we're so careful about not getting America any further into debt. And while I think that's a laudable and certainly a very important thing to look at, not recognizing that we're going to be careful with our pennies and end up wasting pounds by failing to support Ukraine in this, I think is foolhardy.
Well, it is foolhardy. It is also, it's beyond penny wise and pound foolish. You know, 37 states in the United States build the munitions that we, have factories that build the munitions that we send to the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians are not asking for any boots on the ground. In fact, they don't want our boots on the ground. And yet, what they need are weapons. They're having to allocate. They're having to ration shells. You know, 31,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died in the last 2 years. Tens of thousands of civilians. And we beat our breasts about Gaza. No, I think Gaza is a humanitarian shame on all sides. But why do we not have an equal concern when we are so capable of in that situation minimizing the casualties? Why are we suddenly so concerned about the pennies instead of the lives?
Yeah, and again, the fact that this would be not boots on the ground, they're simply asking for the necessary support so that they can fight their own battles, essentially. I'm really at a loss, particularly when there are so-called historical conservatives that look at this and say, yeah, no, we're okay if a despot takes over Ukraine. And you know, as you point out, having Putin specifically mention Poland in his so-called victory speech should really remind everybody that has even a fleeting familiarity with World War II history that we are setting ourselves up for some real problems here. And it's one thing to say, we don't want to get involved. We're not, we got America first. We got to take care of our own, which I get, agree with that. But you can't suddenly pretend as if we're not part of the world, and you can't suddenly abdicate your responsibility to protect democracy, lest you find yourself as the only democracy left standing. And I think the sense of us running from what has been our historical sense of responsibility in this area, and again, to be clear, no, we can't get involved in every war. Yes, things like going into Korea, going into Vietnam, there were just untold numbers of political and militaristic mistakes made in both cases. But now to suggest we're going to fix the problem by staying completely out, I think really defies one's sense of morality, and at the end of the day demonstrates either a horrific ignorance of history, or maybe a willful desire to repeat it. Don't know which. Joyce Cordy with us today, publisher of Reimagine America. We are talking about some of the big political headline stories to capture the news over the last week. And we'll get back to more of that conversation as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
All right, welcome back to the conversation. We're visiting today with Joyce Cordy, publisher of Reimagine America, on the web at reimagineamerica.org. That's reimagineamerica.org. In addition to Poland voicing concerns about getting mentioned in Putin's victory speech, I understand that there are others that have responded to the speech, but not quite in a similar fashion. A few making their pilgrimage, so to speak, to the Kremlin to go and kiss the proverbial ring. Tell us a bit about that and some of the apparent alliances that Putin is beginning to forge in that part of the world.
Well, those are not new territorial conquests for Russia. It's the same theory as the Donbass. Oh, well, these are really Russian-speaking Russian lands. The invasion of Georgia took place around 2005, 2006. And when Georgian soldiers were actually part of the alliance, remember the title, you know, the Title V of NATO, an attack on one is an attack on all. Well, Georgia sent troops in support of the U.S. mission in Iraq, and they and Bush had to send them home to defend Georgia against Russian imperialism. At that point, they saw an opportunity. Another little point is Moldova. Moldova is a tiny little country bordering on Ukraine, near, you know, around the Danube River near the Black Sea. And there too, there was a little enclave that was Russian-speaking, right, that Putin kind of grabbed when he took Crimea. All right, so you have these two leaders of these two breakaway, they call themselves breakaway republics, who immediately rush to Moscow to kiss the hand of Putin, because they are hoping that Putin will win in Ukraine, and then he'll come and take all of Georgia and all of Moldavia and make them the dictators of Georgia and Moldavia, respectively. Now, at the very same moment, the current elected president of larger Moldova was rushing off to Paris to sign a mutual aid agreement with Macron, with Prime Minister of France, which is the first overt movement. And Macron is a strong believer that NATO, that the European Union needs to be militarily independent of the fickle United States. So this is a new movement toward a more independent European Union. And that's not a bad thing. As long as it doesn't interfere with some trade and NATO relationships, that is not in and of itself a bad thing, because it does move us toward the 2% contribution for national security from every NATO country. So I'm not sure. I'm concerned, but I am not concerned that we are. I'm not concerned that we're going to find a big breach with the EU immediately, but there is a concern in the EU based on some of the things that Donald Trump has said about his unequivocal support for NATO should he return to the White House. So I don't think that's a bad thing, but it's a new message. The other thing that we should be paying attention to is Orban's little visit to the United States. Since when does the head of one NATO country come to the United States for a formal meeting, not with the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Secretary of State of the United States, but of a candidate for the presidency.
Well, clearly there's a friendship there, if not a mutual admiration society going on there. And I know that there are a handful of conservatives in the U.S. that seem to be appreciative of Orbán's approach to politics. And to be sure, he's tried to take a stronger, more traditional line in support of marriage and the family and things of that sort. Of course, you know, flip side to that, he's also had a history of shutting down the political opposition, closing down newspapers and media that print stories or do broadcasts that run contrarian to the kind of image that Orbán would like to portray. And so it's a bit of a mixed bag there, in the sense that some view him with a sense of awe that he's been able to sort of restore a sense of unity to the country. And yet, at the other hand, as we talked earlier with Putin, when you're doing the unity by manipulating people or threatening people, then is it really unity?
No, it isn't, because now he kicked a couple of members of parliament out of parliament, and they are starting to build a resistance movement. We'll see how far they get. But the two really important points are, it always has been a tradition since Washington's time that we have one foreign policy at a time. You know, we have an election that can change our foreign policy, but we have one foreign policy at a time. We do not have somebody visiting a candidate and then running back and telling an arch enemy of the United States, our favorite Vladimir Putin, that Trump says he won't give Ukraine a penny. Followed by the recognition that Orbán now wants a piece of the Ukraine. He wants the Carpathian Mountains, which is a beautiful area, just a gorgeous, gorgeous area, a beautiful mountain, not terribly high, but really beautiful, in the southern corner where it meets Hungary.
So we're essentially already anticipating dividing the spoils, as I suggested earlier, the way Stalin and Hitler did with Poland in 1939.
I think your analogy is 100% correct. And yet, Speaker Johnson dithers. He dithers. He says, yeah, I'm supporting Ukraine aid. And yet, he dithers. And last but not least on this subject, when we're talking about U.S. national security, those multiple munitions plants that create thousands and thousands really good-paying American jobs are also the source of our national security. What we're doing is we're building out new weapons systems for our own stockpiles while moving out the existing traditional, what we would call legacy weaponry, to the Ukraine. So there is a mutual, there's a three-way benefit here. And why this has become so difficult and so toxic politically is inexplicable to me. I mean, there has to be a moment when, as Americans, we worry about our own national security, our own economy, and our obligations as the world's leading superpower to use that power judiciously in order to maintain a rules-based world. Putin's aggression across Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, his aspirations in Poland and Lithuania, etc., are and China's interests in Taiwan and North Korea's ambitions in South Korea all speak to a renunciation of the rule of law world order that we have had since the end of World War II.
Well, and it certainly is extremely, it's extremely unsettling, too, because let's face it, while we may wish to not get involved in many parts of these of the world, because either we consider it to be none of our direct business or not worth the financial expenditure, certainly in full-on military language, not worth putting American lives at risk, all very valid points. What becomes problematic is that while it's one thing to say we'd rather not be involved, that's like suggesting, well, my son and daughter-in-law are fighting and they may wind up in divorce court, but we don't want to get involved. Well, guess what? You are involved. This is your family, and you may have grandkids that are going to be impacted by all of this. And the actions that your son and daughter-in-law take can have a direct impact on the entirety of the family. So while you might desire to not be involved, the reality is you don't have any choice. And I think this is largely, in many respects, the issue here, that if we're not in there protecting the interests of those who protect our interests or those with whom we have a common ground, a shared value, and we allow the despots of the world, like Kim Jong-un or like a Putin, to just get away with whatever they want, we're going to find ourselves, if not involved today, voluntarily, in a manner in which we can control, someday involuntarily, and in a manner which is completely out of our control. One comment, well, you know what, I'll save this for when we come back, because I want to get Joyce Cordy to respond to this, and I want to do so without having to interrupt by any interruptions. So let's take a time out. We've got some important messages for you when we come back. More of the conversation with Joyce Cordy from Reimagine America. And the question, what happened to the protection of the ocean, as Lifeline continues?
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Those that forget history are condemned to repeat it. So another quick history lesson. World War II, it was considered to be one of the last great battles that Germany was able to pull off in terms of an offensive. And it happened in a part of Europe that they thought was completely impenetrable. You're familiar with the Battle of the Bulge? It's got nothing to do with your waistline. The Battle of the Bulge referring to this big protrusion of military troops that managed to get through a part that certainly France had considered to be absolutely impassable. They can't get through. It's like the wall of all walls, or Ardennes Forest. Well, guess what? The Germans broke through the line at the Ardennes Forest, and while eventually, of course, they were defeated after 4 months, it cost a lot of American lives to beat the Germans back and to be able to basically move us into the position for victory. That happened in December of 1944. In a modern sense, here in March of 2024, we might think that our Ardennes Forest are the oceans. We are protected from both coasts. Certainly no chance of the Canadians or the Mexicans invading the United States, though some might argue some have. But what of the notion of we are protected by the oceans? That was the watchword, certainly, in 1916, 1917, when we got pulled into the First World War. That was also the idea up until December 7th of 1941, when we got pulled into the Second World War. After that, I think we learned our lesson, but really, have we? And Joyce Cordy, do we run the risk of succumbing to the same sort of foolishness in thinking that America's oceans are somewhat of a protector for us, given the fact that China's been able to float spy balloons over our country, that drones are available, that submarines are available, that ICBMs are available, that could literally, with one or two bombs, wipe out a third of the U.S. continental population?
Yep. We are not safe. We were not safe in World War II. There were actually spy missions in which German submarines landed squadrons of saboteurs on the east coast of the United States. And every now and then we find a Russian submarine lurking around within what we would call our territorial waters. off of Norfolk, off of San Diego. We have another, you know, we've had instances of overflights, as you say, with balloons. No, we're not. I mean, it is, we now have airplanes which are capable of global flight as long as they can refuel in air. All right, so you can carry an ICBM on a missile as close as 3 to 5 miles off the California or New York coastline, for just examples, you know, not exclusive, and launch from there into the interior of the United States. So we are not safe. And as far back as Reagan, people laughed at Reagan because you don't even need, we know that Kim has a ballistic missile, which isn't capable, knock on wood, of carrying a nuclear warhead, but is capable of reaching the west coast of the United States. So, you know, I think we need to think back to the Reagan era, when Reagan suggested we needed, you know, a defensive missile capability along the coasts of the United States and Canada.
And, you know, you reminded me about an important point. I'll just mention, for the benefit of listeners, there is a brilliant book out. I read it about a year ago. It's published by Regnery Press, called Panic on the Pacific: How America Prepared for War on the West Coast. And it does, in fact, delineate a number of times in which, no, it wasn't a attack in the sense that, you know, cities got bombed, people got killed, but they not only got submarines to the Pacific coast, they got balloons to the Pacific coast, and they even got a couple of airplanes to the Pacific coast. And so, you know, if there was a vulnerability, given how primitive many of this technology was at the time during World War II, then you've got to believe come 2024, there is a risk there. So somehow to suggest that we don't need to be worried about what's going on in Asia, what's going on in Europe, because after all, here we are in the United States and the oceans will protect us, pretty much demonstrative of not only an ignorance of the world today, but an ignorance of history, I would say.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we need to be, again, we need to be making sure we are preparing to fight today's war and not yesterday's war, in terms of how we spend money, how we manage our defense, our alliances, and our defenses. The current work between the UK, the Australians, and the Americans to build a new class of submarines, very important to the security of the mainland. There is another very good book that's a bit prophetic, by Admiral Sarvides, the former NATO chief, and a really learned scholar on the subject of global naval politics. It's a book called 2034, and it talks about a future, the potential of future conflict between the United States and China. And if you are unconcerned about our future, and the protection that the oceans afford us, I suggest that you read it. It's not a very long book. It's a couple hundred pages. It's a novel. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty well written, and well worth your time on this subject. But no, we are, the ocean is not, no longer a protection for us. Not just on the coast. If you're in Chicago and you're listening to this broadcast on the internet, you are not safe either.
Bush 41, George Bush, as the collapse of the Soviet Union was taking place, and we saw not only the fall of communism along the eastern border there in the Iron Curtain region, you know, starting with countries like, I think Romania was the first one to fall, and they kind of went like dominoes after that, and eventually by 1991, if memory serves me right, the Soviet Union had collapsed, and George Bush at the time talked about reaping the peace dividend, that we had fought the so-called Cold Cold War, since the close of the Second World War, that went out through the course of, you know, four decades, and now we're going to reap the rewards. There will be a peace dividend. Has that dividend largely eluded us, given the number of wars that we've been in, be it, you know, sparked by disputes or sparked by terrorism since that time?
Yeah, I think it's it was for maybe a year or two an illusion, but since the 1990s, when Bush made that statement, we have seen war in that we've been involved in Kosovo, in the Middle East. We are still involved in the Middle East today. We have troops on the ground. And I suspect we'll be in Haiti pretty quickly, and because somebody's got to do it. And I think the peace and the fact that our adversaries were not into the concept of the peace dividend. You know, you can only lay down your arms, and so do your would-be adversary. So, no, I don't think there's ever been a peace dividend. I think that's been a mistake. You know, I mean, we've talked about guns and butter as far back as Johnson, and we aren't there yet. But munitions are a major export, by the way, in the United States, or from the United States. So, no, I don't think there's been a peace dividend.
I'm glad you brought up Haiti. I want to pivot to that for just a brief moment. 90 miles off the coast of Florida. I've been to Haiti. Haiti, on a good day, is a disastrous scenario from a human well-being circumstance or viewpoint. I mean, everything from systemic political corruption in that country to untold numbers of natural disasters, and the island, or at least their portion of the island, ravaged by everything from AIDS in the 1980s to hurricanes, certainly earthquakes. I mean, I remember being there on the heels of a major earthquake that did significant damage in the capital of Port-au-Prince. And here, 5-6 years after the fact, rubble had not even been removed from some of the sites where buildings collapsed. I mean, it is a country that struggles at every turn. Right now, though, there's been an implosion. The duly elected, democratically elected president was assassinated. The prime minister has been trying to kind of drive the bus, but not doing a very good job. They have held off on calling for new elections. And as we've seen, it's now just exploded. And there's even news that some of that is encouraging similar circumstances potentially from happening even in a place like Cuba. Do you think it's a matter of if or when we find ourselves boots on the ground in Haiti to try and get a hold of the situation?
Well, I think we're already engaged in trying to bring some level of stability. Lincoln was in Jamaica at a meeting last week trying to put together some sort of international organization. But you know what? After that earthquake that you caused you to visit Haiti, we did have international aid. The Israelis helped send field hospitals. George Bush and Bill Clinton put together a huge fundraising effort. We did, you know, we had gave people temporary asylum. We adopted children who were orphaned. We did a lot, and none of it made a dent in bringing stability to Haiti as a nation. I mean, I can't think of a moment in your or my lifetime when Haiti has in fact been a peaceful country. And so what do? The people, the Dominican Republic has absolutely, which is the other half of the same island, right, says nobody is with a Haitian passport is crossing this line. And so far they have been able to hold that. So I think at some point, at least from a humanitarian point of view, we will have to do more than sending Marines to protect the embassy. I'm not sure what form that takes. Because you've got to have, but you can't just, you know, parachute in and stick around for a year or two and say, okay, on to the next. You have to really do what we did in the 1920s. We actually occupied Haiti for about a decade in an effort to civilize it and stabilize it. And you can't, you know, it's as you say, it's a combination of political instability and natural forces that have just kept the Haitians from ever really getting a solid economic footing that would allow them to build a peaceful society.
It's not easy to say we don't want to get involved. I mean, look at what's beginning to transpire, as I alluded to a moment ago, in Cuba. Ongoing economic crisis there. Now they're beginning to see not only times of day when the electricity gets shut off, fuel shortages, food shortages, you know, once again proving that the communistic system of economics is a failed system, and that country was propped up for so many decades by the Soviet Union. But now Russia, in her stead, while they've attempted to, they just don't have the economic wherewithal either. I mean, my goodness, more than half of the Russian economy is black market economy, so much is running kind of below the radar screen. What would you anticipate? I mean, if Cuba's allowed to continue to sort of sit there and simmer in their own economic juices, and we do not take any intervention action in Haiti, are we looking at a potential boat people crisis again, invading Florida?
Yes. In a word, absolutely.
Wow.
I mean, we are talking, one of the things we're talking about is we are capturing Haitians at sea every day, is we're talking about sending them to Guantanamo because we don't want to give them wet foot, dry foot status in the United States. So I think we're going to have to do something in Haiti, all right? And Cuba is, when Cuba explodes, Cuba will be an American problem. It will be a North American problem. Yeah, it'll be us, it'll be the Canadians, it'll be the Mexicans, it'll be, you know, Colombia, et cetera, because there really isn't any choice. It will be a huge opportunity for Venezuela to go looking for oil territory. And that is, you know, that's a risk to the stability of the entire Western Hemisphere. So, yeah, we've got, but Craig, don't for a moment leave out of that puzzle the failure of the United States to take care of its own territories in terms of bringing Puerto Rico back from the disastrous hurricane that hit it as well.
Yeah, we kind of gave that about 15 minutes worth of attention, and then we said, we're busy over here. And that's problematic, as you point out, because that is a U.S. territory. People that live in Puerto Rico are United States citizens, and yet we've been kind of asleep at the switch on that. Joyce, we're perilously running out of time, but one of the topics I want to get you back on for, because it I think kind of really hits to your arena of expertise, of folks that may not be aware, Joyce has been involved in the corporate America for decades. She's kind of a corporate fixer in a sense. She knows how to go in, ascertain where the problems are, and get the corporate ship of state righted. Well, if we talk about economics, one of the things that we've got to touch on is, number one, further discussions about more tariffs, which many economists believe the last big round of tariff increases is what's contributed to our current inflation situation, because at the end of the day, companies don't absorb increases in taxes. They pass those expenses on. And then you look at that issue combined with another major ongoing economic issue, and that is the habit of this Congress and so many others before it to just kick the can down the road. We can't come to an agreement, so we're gonna temporarily fix things, but we're just not going to come up with an annual budget. We're just going to come up with our budget 1 month or one quarter or one resolution at a time. And I think it's not only shameful, it's demonstrative of a Congress that's not doing the job it was hired to do, but in the end, could it potentially spell economic disaster for us? And that's one of the points I'd love to have you dive into next week, Joyce.
I'm happy to dive into that one, but let me leave our listeners with just one vignette. You worry about the air traffic control system, right?
Yep.
Well, Canada has a wholly owned, you know, subsidiary that is their air traffic control system. And you know what? It's 10 times more modern than ours, with a fraction of the traffic. And the reason is that they fund it 5 years at a time. So you can let a contract to a contractor to build a piece of your system and know in 5 years you're going to be able to connect the next piece. We can't do that. We're now running our air traffic control modernization system on 6 month cycles.
Wow.
That's economically incomprehensible to somebody like me who studied economics.
Well, this is the problem when you get a bunch of people back in Washington, D.C. that are calling the financial shots and have no experience in managing a company, managing a corporation, let alone economically managing a country. Joyce Cordy with Reimagine America on the web at reimagineamerica.org, reimagineamerica.org.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.